If you heard my recent podcast with Grandmaster Jan Gustafsson and FIDE Master Donnie Ariel, you might have been surprised to hear that Donnie is spending 10 hours editing each 10-minute video that he does without hiring help. If you're in a situation like Donnie, you should hire help. And if you're looking to hire help quickly, then you should use Indeed.com. When it comes to hiring, Indeed is all you need. So stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other sites. Indeed's sponsored jobs help you stand out and hire fast. With sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates so you can reach the people you want faster. And it makes a huge difference. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. One of the great things about Indeed is that it makes hiring faster so that you can focus on other priorities within your work, such as Donnie actually making the videos rather than editing the videos. Plus, with Indeed sponsored jobs, there are no monthly subscriptions, no long-term contracts, and you only pay for results. How fast is Indeed? In the minute I've been talking to you, 23 hires were made on Indeed, according to the Indeed data worldwide. So there's no need to wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring, Indeed is all you need. When I started the Perpetual Chess podcast back in 2016, it was because I knew that chess was a big part of a lot of people's lives, including my own, but it wasn't so easy to find conversations about the game. I had a lot to learn, and I had a lot of fear and insecurity about my ability to do all of the tasks required to put out a quality podcast. But I found that you can do more than you think if you break your problems down into small pieces and take it one step at a time. And a tool like Shopify makes it possible for anyone to make their business dreams happen. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the US, from household names like Mattel and Gymshark to brands just getting started. If you can't design a website, Shopify's got you from the get-go with beautiful, ready-to-go templates to match your brand style. If you need a hand, get help with everyday tasks like enhancing product images, writing product descriptions, or generating discount codes with Shopify's AI tools created for commerce. If people hadn't heard about your brand, Shopify helps you find your customers with easy-to-run email and social media campaigns. And if you get stuck, Shopify is always around to share advice with their award-winning 24/7 customer support. So turn those dreams into and give them the best shot at success with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/chess. Go to shopify.com/chess, shopify.com/chess.
USAA knows dynamic duos can save the day, like superheroes and sidekicks or auto and home insurance. With USAA, you can bundle your auto and home and save up to 10%. Learn more and get a quote at usaa.com/bundle. Restrictions apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. We have a guest I have wanted to interview since the beginnings of Perpetual Chess back in 2016, and it's finally happening. I am super excited. It's actually happening at a crazy time. So this interview won't come out until early May, but we're recording on April 3rd, which is a day after, who knows what will happen in the next month, but it's a day after the latest rounds of Trump's tariffs, which our guest has just said was perhaps the most consequential economic event since the U.S. went off the gold standard. So again, we don't know what the future holds, and we're not going to discuss current events that won't be as current, but I'm guessing there will still be some drama when you listen. So our guest is an author and professor of economics at Harvard University. He's the former chief economist of the IMF. He's also a grandmaster and was one of the brightest talents of his generation. He won the U.S. Junior Championship in 1969 at age 16. As a young adult, was ranked as highly as number 40 in the world and finished as high as second in the U.S. Championship in 1965, which earned him a spot in the 1976 Interzonal Tournament in Biel. Our guest actually dropped out of high school to pursue chess professionally, living in former Yugoslavia and traveling all over Europe. But at 18, As you may discern, he switched his focus to academics and enrolled at Yale and thus spawned the career he has now had. He first came on my own radar in 2008 and 2009. I was a professional poker player at the time and trying to figure out why I was losing so much money in financial markets. So I became aware of their book, This Time is Different, about the history of financial crises. And I couldn't believe it when he found out he's a grandmaster. His new book is called Our Dollar, Your Problem. It's about the past and future of the U.S. dollar as a world reserve currency. I read it. I enjoyed it. I learned it a lot. You'd be surprised how much chess is mentioned in the book, as we will eventually discuss. But what we are going to do this episode is begin by talking about his short but fascinating chess career, then get into the book. And without further ado, I'm honored to welcome Dr. Kenneth Rogoff to the show. Welcome, Dr. Rogoff.
Well, thank you, Ben. By the way, it's so cool what you've done. I wish you were around when I was around. It's just so fantastic how chess has changed. I mean, you know, frankly, it was very lonely being a chess player in the United States. I lived in Rochester, New York. We had a great chess club, and it's not that I didn't have chess friends, but it's very isolating, and you didn't have ways to reach out to people. And so it's just wonderful that you have your fantastic podcast and other things that have had more connections.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah, I'm 48. So I remember eagerly waiting for the Chess Life magazine to come because we were so starved for information about chess. And I'm sure in your when you were coming up a couple decades earlier, it was probably that feeling was amplified.
Yeah, no, I actually eventually got a subscription to 64, the Russian magazine, because I knew Fisher was doing it. But yeah, no, it was, you didn't have a lot of information, especially as an American, because the Europeans went from tournament to tournament. So they, you know, they had very up-to-date news on the openings. So it actually affected how I played. I tried not to steer down the middle of the road in the openings I chose and played the Caro Kann, the Petrov, you know, things that became popular later, precisely because I just wouldn't know the latest moves in the Neidorf and stuff. But, you know, nowadays you can be off and, you know, nowhere and at least, you know, get a ways on learning it. It's still very clear that if you're around a big chess center, or you get to play in the top tournaments, it helps a lot. I don't know what exactly the information flow is, but yeah, it's putting together information. That was a lot of our work back then, was just organizing data, you know, figuring out what books you could read. It was a different era.
Yeah. And obviously the Soviet cadre, as you alluded to, they had the ability to exchange information so easily. So I'm sure you were swimming upstream, as was Bobby Fischer, as you mentioned. And Dr. Rogoff, I actually wanted to start with an amazing story from Bobby Fischer. So Grandmaster Rogoff has written a brief chess biography that you can find on his Harvard faculty page. And he links to this article that Fischer wrote in 1969 about Dr. Rogoff. So this is just amazing. I'm going to read the first two paragraphs and then I'd love to hear the story behind it. So Bobby Fischer, and again, he didn't annotate a lot of games that weren't his own. And just to place this in context, this is before he's world champion, but already a huge star and household name in the U.S. So Bobby Fischer writes, "The other day I dropped over to the U.S. Junior Championship at the McAlpin Hotel in New York City and saw some very talented young players in action struggling for the title. It brought back memories of years ago when I used to be in those events. The player that impressed me most was 16-year-old Ken Rogoff from Rochester, New York. What I liked best about Ken, who won the championship, was his self-assured style and his knowing exactly what he wanted over the chessboard. I'm told he's only been playing chess 2 or 3 years, and it should encourage each of you young fellows who read this column to know that by applying yourself, as Ken did, you can become a fine player in a relatively short time too." So what a feather in your cap. And I know you eventually got to know Bobby Fischer. Was this where you met him, or did you already know him then?
No. Actually, the only period I really had any interaction with him was that week where he visited. It felt like almost every day at the U.S. Junior Championship. And frankly, some of the other players hung out with him more than I did because I was up in my room working on my openings to prepare for the game. But I certainly spent a chunk of time with him. And, you know, we were thrilled beyond imagination. He wasn't the world champion yet. But he was obviously the best player in the world already. It hadn't taken place yet. You know, think if your, you know, high school basketball team and LeBron James walks in and says, you know, I'll show you a few things, or, you know, other analogies. We, you know, all of us were just sort of wondering, why would he visit us? You know, why would he look at our games? Why would he spend time? And of course, you know, part of being the great player that he was is he would look for ideas in other places. He, you know, now 16 nowadays, maybe he's considered an old man, but I mean, Gukesh, what was just turning 18 as he won the world championship. But, you know, young players often have fresh takes on openings and stuff. So, you know, he was incredibly nice and went over games. And the thing that really stuck in my mind the most was that he had not been strong at rook endings for a while. It was a weakness in his game. By not being strong, instead of being, what did he reach, 2780 or something, he was only, you know, 2680 at rook endings. Right. And it mattered. When you want to win every game, when, you know, want to do what he did, it really mattered. And he evidently locked himself in a room for 3 months, he told us, you know, hotel room with no window, and just studied and studied. And you saw it. It came out. I remember he won a game, I think it was against Geller, where he just outplayed him in a rook ending. Now, Magnus Carlsen does that like magic now. But, you know, it was really impressive. And then the particular game of mine that he annotated, and I may be wrong, but I think there are only a couple of games by non-dead people that he annotated that weren't his own. You know, he showed me some moves, suggestions in the opening that I thought about for years, long after I retired. I kept thinking about recommendations. I mean, if I can be a little in the weeds just for a second with your listeners, you know, in the Caro Kann, the classical Caro Kann, where white plays knight c3 after d5, d takes e, knight takes e4, bishop f5. Our game didn't reach that, but he showed us this. He said, yeah, I like playing knight c5. In exhibition games. I mean, you can look that up in a computer. The move never occurred to me. Right. And I thought about it afterwards, and I never looked at a computer about it. And then, you know, there are other variations. He gives a few. I'm not sure they were better or worse than what I played, but, you know, I mean, I think he looked at one point on move 4 playing, you know, queen f3 or something like that.
That's what you were going to suggest, because I knew it wasn't going to be knight c3.
After knight c3, like, our game took on a slightly different path. But it was really fun and exciting. I will say that I was 16, but before the article appeared, I had met Karpov, who was a couple years older than me. And, you know, he worked harder than me, or as hard as I did. He was totally focused on chess. I mean, I was too at that time, but I could see that. He had all this help and knowledge and just a feel for the game that was, you know, I was thinking, you know, I'm not going to beat him. I mean, when I met him, I didn't actually even play him in that tournament. I again qualified in 1971, and I didn't win, but came within a hair. I got sick. I know chess players always say that, but I did big time. I had to mess around. But in 1969, I choked in the preliminaries. I didn't even qualify for the finals. I was watching his games. I spent some time with him. And it was, you know, he won this game against Ulf Andersen. I invite your readers to, sorry, I keep saying readers. I'm such an academic. Your listeners, viewers to see. It was just from another planet. And Ulf Andersen was strong at that time. He was already a fantastic player. I lost to him in that tournament. And Fischer saying, you're really promising. But I'm pretty sure he said when I met him that he thought Karpov was a potzer. And I'm thinking, he probably doesn't think I'm ever going to beat him. You know,
right.
Like saying that. So anyway, I'm sure he was right.
amazing stories. And let me ask, so as Fischer alluded to, you had only been playing competitive chess for a few years when you were 16. And as you wrote on your chess biography, you learned when you were 6. So I was curious, what changed when you were 13, where you went from knowing how the pieces move to not only learning how to play or playing seriously, but then just rocket like ascension over the next few years.
So I loved chess right away when I was, sorry about my voice. I loved chess right away when I was six, but I really didn't have a chess club. We didn't have all the school chess that we have now. I played with my friends who got tired of playing with me. But what changed when I was 13 is I had friends I played football and basketball with who went to the Rochester Chess Club. Rochester, for most people, is in the middle of nowhere. It's near Niagara Falls for for many people up near in what is truly upstate New York. But we had a really good chess club. We had the New York State champion, Eric Marchand. Now, the New York State Championship's a tournament. As you well know, winning that doesn't really make you the best player in New York State. I guess if Bobby Fischer played, he would have won. But he was New York State champion several times. And he had a chess club. He worked at Kodak. And I learned a lot. And, you know, Rochester happened to have a great style. So the Rochester Chess Club, because of Dr. Marchand, he was a PhD engineer, he emphasized end games and technique. He was really thoughtful. He steered for end games. And believe me, young players were not doing that in my day. I mean, you watch Magnus Carlsen. And it helped me a lot because I mentioned I didn't get to learn the fanciest, newest openings, but I gained confidence at endgames from learning them, not just from him, but the whole chess club. So I would go to New York and the young players, Sal Matera, you know, many others, super talented. Why are you playing such, Norman Weinstein was another. Why are you playing such passive openings? The Petrov, the Caro Kann, why would you do that? And because if we get to an end game, you're in trouble. So I learned a lot. Of course, that's not enough to really develop. I had to learn a lot of other things.
And you've talked in interviews about chess obsession. Obviously, to reach the levels you did, some degree of that is necessary. But so in those 3 years, you discover the Rochester Chess Club. Like, what were your days like? I mean, you're still going to school, but how much chess were you able to cram into those days?
Well, I spent all my time at chess. I mean, when I wasn't at school and playing in chess tournaments and thinking about chess. And of course, after I started traveling at 17 and 18 and living in Europe, I was a professional. I really was earning money. I think I really was supporting myself. I didn't quite know how to deal with earning money. And so I would alternate between living in five-star hotels when I was playing in a Grandmaster tournament. And I literally would sleep in train stations and park benches sometimes when I didn't quite want to spend the money, youth hostels. But I continued to play chess when I went to Yale. That's all I did in the summers and a little bit after that. So I love chess. I'm still addicted to it. There's no question about it. I still think about it all the time. I think part of my brain is hardwired to play chess. I won't say I wish it was something else because it makes me happy. But it's definitely, I think I read you play poker too.
Yeah.
So they're very related. And yeah. you need to be addicted to be good. But I think at the same time, it does make it hard to give it up. I stopped playing completely, but I certainly haven't given up following it. And I've gotten so many letters and calls over the years from very prominent players. I want to say a U.S. champion, a Chinese champion, a French champion, a Russian champion. I've hit 30 and I'm thinking of giving up chess. What do I do? It's also not easy to make a transition from being so good at something to just inevitably having to work your way up at something else.
So what's your stock advice, having gotten that question so many times?
Well, you know, first of all, I want to say, I think if I had stayed a professional chess player, I would have been very happy. No world championship, maybe a couple US championships, but maybe. But I think I would have had a very happy life. I admire my friends and colleagues who did that. But I think you do have to at least go through a period of cold turkey. That's what I say, because you have to accept that you're not going to be as good. And I'll just mention a couple moments from my life. I mean, I was a good test taker. That's what got me through school. You just memorize stuff. But I wasn't, even as I rose, you know, went to college, went to graduate school, I wasn't passionate about economics in the same way that I was about chess. That came a few years after I graduated. And I remember, I got a job at the Federal Reserve, which was fantastic. I had a great job, but I was in a research department producing nothing. I would sit on the floor all day in the morning, not sure what I was supposed to do. I hadn't got my head around, I wasn't writing nothing, but it wasn't earth shattering. And I remember, one time, probably coming back from a baseball game with a more senior Stanford professor, and who was a friend of my friend's, and he was dropping us off. And he sort of jokingly said, "See you, Kenan. Oh, yes, yeah, send me all your papers." And he said that very sarcastically and bitingly, like there never would be. And you have to, I felt it. He meant it. And, you have to go through that. I mean, that's just part of working your way up. I'm sure I don't know if you switch from chess to poker, and back, but you go through this learning curve and
yep.
You never know where it's going. And you kind of have to put yourself through that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I'm sure you're getting it on both sides. You get it from, as you try to pursue academia, you get the people saying, you're spending half your time on chess. And as you pursue chess, you're spending half your time on academics.
Exactly. I wrote one kind of good paper when I was in graduate school. So I got interviewed at a couple top universities. And one of them is actually a famous professor, Steve Ross at Yale, amazing scholar, said, "Well, we really like your paper and you gave a good seminar, but it's just hard to believe you're going to be serious and you're going to be here all the time and working all the time." So we're very reluctant to take someone who's not really committed. And I mentioned it took a few years. I think the paper of mine that kind of transformed me, I'd done a little bit before then, was I got the idea of, we had very high inflation in the 70s. We will again, by the way, with what's going on. But we had very high inflation in the 70s. And there was a question of what to do about it. And nowadays, everybody talks about the Federal Reserve, what the Federal Reserve going to do. And they talk about that in every country, what the Bank of England's going to do, what the New Zealand Central Bank's going to do. If you follow the Goldman letters or the financial world, it's all they look at. They didn't have independent central banks back then. Even the Federal Reserve, which was the most independent central bank next to the Bundesbank, was not all that independent. And so I wrote the first paper on why it worked to have an independent central bank. Why would it be a good idea? And by the way, I had a very hard time publishing it. I mean, it was not easy. But what I noticed myself up at 3 a.m. once, papers spread around the floor, working on equations. And, I was thinking, I'm an economist now, actually caring about this. Because right. With chess, of course, I would do that all the time. I mean, if I got an idea about a chess opening or something, you'd think about it at night. And so, like I said, that was probably 7 or 8 years after I started graduate school.
Wow. And you mentioned the challenges of getting published, and chess, obviously, as you mentioned, can be challenging as a profession, has its ups and downs. You really got to make it to the top. But the one good thing, or one of the good things about chess, is it's at least 90% meritocracy. Invites matter at the edges. Certainly Hans Niemann is wishing he was getting more invites around now. But if you reach the top rating in the world, you're going to have plenty of opportunity. But in the academic world, obviously, you kind of have to be picked, especially in your era. So was that a frustrating change for you, going from this almost pure meritocracy to one of the least meritocratic endeavors?
Okay, well, I'm not going to quite buy into what you're saying. You have a point. And it's much more true in the very modern era than it was in my era. Nevertheless, I mean, it's a different world in academics. So in chess, you're sort of graded or viewed more on your average performance. Even in a game, one bad move and you're ruined. Whereas in academics, you can write 10 terrible papers, and most of the time, everybody forgets about them. You're trying for that. It's almost like you're trying to win the beauty prize, the brilliancy prize in every tournament, and you don't care about the other games. It's a little bit different. But, certainly, I'm a big believer in meritocracy. I think it's been a big mistake to try to downplay it. to say that it's unimportant. For example, when a lot of universities were giving up SATs, the school exams in the United States you have to take to get in, started during COVID and continued. I mean, that was a big mistake because, okay, it's got a lot of problems. You need to control for the fact that some people get more preparation, but you can do that. But you can come from nowhere and get a good SAT. And so I think that's something that needs some rebalancing. So yes, but on the other hand, academics is like pretty tough. I mean, we have a sort of trial by fire system. And I think certainly mostly the best ideas get out there, not always. And sometimes some pretty terrible ideas rule for a long time because politics somehow intervenes. But yes, no, I wish, it's wonderful about chess that it's such a meritocracy.
But you weren't feeling like you weren't getting like you felt like when you deserved it, the recognition came in the academic world.
Nobody feels they're getting recognition right. That they had. I mean, one colleague and later co-author of mine, Maury, had his first journal article, and he went to one of his colleagues at Columbia and said, who do I send it to? How many copies should I order? They were expensive. And the older professor said, well, that depends. How many mothers do you have? Yeah, I mean, it's one thing. You can write something that you think's really important and it's hard to get out there and you have to be patient. So sometimes you're wrong. The best thing in academics is when nobody thinks you're right and says you're not right. And then 5, better yet, 10 years later, they say, oops, you were completely right.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had some experience with that. And returning to your chess era, I found it unbelievable that you dropped out of high school at 16. I mean, it would be surprising for a top young player to do that now, but to do that circa 1969, I mean, your parents must have been mortified. The world felt bigger, you know, to go from living in Rochester to living in Zagreb. I mean, it's just a shocking change. Like, how long did this process take and how scared or not scared were you?
Well, I kept some tether to school in the sense like I went to a school in Hampstead in London for a few weeks and got a chess friend to write that I was there the whole time kind of thing, but obviously didn't have grades and stuff. And I tried to keep some contacts with high school, but my parents were very upset about it. I mean, they did, you know, nowadays your parents would be upset that you were wandering around Europe on your own with, you know, and nowadays, I think when most kids that age do it, their parents going with them and nobody was going with me. I mean, I was just like, I went up to visit a classmate from high school who was in Rennes, France. She was taking a year abroad. I went up to stay with her for a few days. And then I said, I think I'll go to Yugoslavia. I had no idea where it was. I think I took the train in the wrong direction at one point, and the conductor was really nice and let me, you know, continue. And, you know, it was an interesting experience. And certainly I took a lot away from it besides the chess. But, you know, now, I mean, I'd never let my kid do that for 1,000 reasons. I felt, first of all, my high school had a lot of trouble. There were huge riots at the high school at the time. It was a very tough inner city high school. So being away wasn't so bad. In fact, I didn't tell anyone I played chess. I was afraid to. And it wasn't until I was in the local newspapers that the other kids knew. And so, I mean, I won't say I was timid or, you know, I don't want to think somebody getting beat up on or something, but I felt like I did myself a favor by, you know, not continuing there.
And your dad was, correct me if I'm wrong, he was a professor?
He was a distinguished radiologist. He was head of the American Diagnostic Radiology Association. Yes, he was a professor at the University of Rochester. I mean, mostly he practiced. And, you know, saying, why don't you want to be a doctor? Are you out of your mind? You know, I'm sure so many of our listeners have parents, you know, who said the same thing. And yeah, I mean, I love chess. I was very happy. And I wasn't thinking that many moves ahead, to be honest.
And but he also insisted on sending you to this rough and tumble public school.
He did. They were real. They were liberals. They were big believers in having us live in the inner city. My father never earned a lot, actually. He made a big point. Back then, if you were just a university radiologist and did no consulting, you didn't earn much. And, you know, he would proudly say to me, you know, one of my friends, colleagues went and consulted for Sam Walton, who was sick. He's the founder of Walmart. Yeah. And, you know, I don't remember the number. They paid him $5,000. Can you believe he did that? I'm going like, Dad, why aren't you doing that? Right. But it was sort of, you know, he said, I get the most interesting work. I love what I do. And I'm passionate about it. And, you know, he lived that way. Unfortunately, he passed away in his late 50s. He might have earned a lot later, because the world changed, but never got to that.
Wow. Amazing perspective between that upbringing and then going to Europe when you're 16. So what was the biggest challenge? We're going to take a quick break from this fascinating conversation with Dr. Kenneth Rogoff to tell you about our sponsors, including, of course, Chessable.com. Their newest courses include The Battle-Tested Scandinavian Defense by friend of the pod, Grandmaster Arturs Nixons and GM Igor Kovalenko, Practical Old Indian. They've also got tactic courses, end game courses. If you decide to sign up for Chessable Pro to unlock additional benefits, be sure to use the link in the description. We'll be back with lots more from Dr. Rogoff after the break.
That was another cool song you heard just a second ago. Gotta tell you, that's a real vibe. You got great taste as a listener, and I notice you like a lot of variety too. So I know you'll like a refreshing ice cold McAllister's Famous Tea. You can get it lots of different ways. Unsweet as lemonade tea or with a flavor shot like black cherry or strawberry or peach. We got all that good taste coming your way at McAllister's Deli. Variety is on the menu.
You're not just chasing a win. You're chasing greatness. And greatness isn't just about the grind. It's about your own personal style and the mindset to take it to the next level. Shop your local Nike store, where you can find everything from the season's hottest drops to exclusive community experiences. You can elevate your game with the latest in running innovation, the Air Max family, and classic Nike favorites. Discover your local Nike store today and unleash your greatness.
At the Hyundai Getaway Sales Event, get deals so right, it almost feels wrong. Now's the best time to get that Hyundai you've always wanted. Plus, every new Hyundai comes with America's best warranty and 3 years or 36,000 miles of limited complimentary maintenance. Don't think you can get away with all that? Think again. The Hyundai Getaway Sales Event. Visit your local Hyundai dealer today. It's a great day for a new Hyundai.
Oh, I mean, you've got language barriers, like you said, learning to manage money, actually finding the chess tournaments. What was the biggest challenge of those years?
Well, I mean, I was doing well enough that when I got into tournaments, life was fine. But I think the biggest challenge was finding the tournaments. There were very few, especially I was looking to play in really strong tournaments. And I did speak a decent amount of Russian. I had learned some Russian in high school, believe it or not. I don't know why they had a Russian course at this otherwise school, which didn't have a lot of things, but they did. And that let me get by. And Yugoslavia, by the way, encompasses Croatia, Serbia, and of course, Bosnia today, and met several other places. And they had to learn Russian. You had to learn Russian. And so what I learned to do is to speak in English. At first, nobody spoke English, so they didn't hate you. And then I would switch to speaking Russian. I wouldn't speak great Russian. By the way, my wife, Natasha, part of how I met her was her maiden name was Susan, which is not maiden name or birth name. It's no giveaway because it's in her book, recent book, Muppets in Moscow. She tells all about that. But I mean, she was lived a lot of her life in Russia, and I probably met her because of Russian. I'd forgotten my Russian, but you know what's been great is she can't talk behind my back. I still know enough Russian. So but I mean, I spent all my time at chess. It was, you know, a strange period because a certain amount of physical insecurity. I think when I first arrived at Yugoslavia, I had a tournament in Zagreb, and that was great. What's sort of cool about the tournament was I was used to playing in the United States when no one knew the tournament was going on. I mean, I don't know what it's like today, but you go in Yugoslavia and Zagreb, I would walk into a bar and somebody would say, why did you play so stupid today? I bet on you. I mean, what?
Wow.
And by the way, women played chess, which, you know, nowadays has changed a lot, but back then was, you know, it existed in California especially, but it was a relative rarity. So I felt a little more socially accepted, not like Bobby Fischer, who was a national hero. You probably recall when he went, he got what, like 2,000 marriage proposals. I think I got one. But, you know, still, it was liberating in some sense to be someplace where you felt normal being a chess player.
And then you make this big U-turn. I mean, you're not even in high school, and then you end up at Yale. You've written that they looked liberally, or they gave a liberal interpretation to your, obviously you're quite accomplished in the world of chess, but not your typical resume. Were you expecting to be able to go to an elite university? And also, of course, I'm curious why you sort of, I guess, changed your mind.
So back then, and it's still true today, if you're sufficiently good at something, you can get into any of the top universities. And chess was big, thanks to Bobby Fischer. And I'd probably had my games in the New York Times, which back then was a thing, 15 times, you know, back then. I was in Who's Who, believe it or not, which was a thing back then.
I remember that.
Yeah. And I did well on the SATs. I don't want to say what my SATs were because I didn't do that well, but I did right. Well. So I kind of expected to get in wherever I applied. That may have been dumb, but I expected that. I more or less only applied to Yale and Stony Brook, I think, because my aunt and uncle lived in Yale, and I thought it would be a tough transition. I really love them, and so that's why I went there.
Okay. And then, as you said, chess on the back burner during the school year, but full throttle during the summers. We have a listener question that you touched upon, but I'd like for you to flesh out a little bit more. So this one is from Francois Legrand. Thank you for helping to support Perpetual Chess, Francois. And he writes that although you had an illustrious career, so you mentioned that you didn't feel like you could have been world champion, but he was curious if you ever daydream of what would have happened if you'd pursued chess full time, like what your life would have been like.
To be completely honest, I daydream about chess a lot, but I don't so much. And I think about individual games of where I did something stupid or something, you know, mistakes I made, I still think about. But I don't. I've never looked back on that. It was when I was doing the decision, I thought about it a lot. I talked to a lot of people. I just made it. But, I kind of committed myself mentally to making the switch when I went to school. I've often said this, but there were sort of three reasons. One is that I didn't like to travel so much. And to be a chess player, you have to travel a lot. Second, when I was back in Rochester, I had some semblance of a normal social life. I won't say I was as cool as you or our friend Jennifer Shahad, but you know, I had some social life. And when I was traveling, I had none. I mean, I didn't know what to do, and I really just didn't. And third, I thought I wanted to do something more important with my life. And of course, years later, I realized I'm an international economist. I travel a lot. There are a lot of great women in my field now, but probably not when I was coming up. And I think chess is art and sport. And I think you give a lot to the world by playing great chess. I mean, all the top chess players, you know, play games that are played over by millions and millions of people. Your podcast is listened to by millions and millions of people. So, you know, I realized some of what I had problems with was me. I mean, that there were things inside me. I did notice, I will add, that some of the older chess players I met, I was so energized about chess, I was rising. But I met some of these grandmasters who were on the other side of the curve, and they just seemed a little depressed to me. I could see they were doing okay financially, but I noticed that. But I think what motivated me the most was the first three things I said.
Yeah,
all valid reasons. And yeah, while if you reach the top, you certainly can create beauty in chess, and we all look to better ourselves. We're not chief economists at the IMF, so it seems like you made a good decision. And I want to get to your book, but a couple more chess questions. So number one, I found it amazing that you wrote that you really, despite, as you say, thinking about chess all the time, you really quit cold turkey. You played Magnus in an exhibition game in 2012, but you've said that you didn't play a game of chess for like decades before that?
No, that's right. Not a single game. I mean, the only the full list of exceptions. Once, I think around 1983, I played a game in Washington Square Park and then left. I don't know why I did it. And I did a blindfold exhibition in, I want to say, 2003 against high school players, just to see if I could still do it. I think I played 12 or 14 players. I wasn't as sharp, but I did it. But that was it. No casual games, no nothing. I think once with my wife's best friend, when I was just meeting her, had a six-year-old kid who I'm talking to later today, who wanted to play, and I had to, but her father wanted to play. I didn't play with him. I mean, I just didn't. So no, that was the only game, not even against computers, I hadn't played.
Amazing that you were able to stay sharp enough to do a blindfold simo, and then you drew Magnus. So what are your memories of that game?
Well, I mean, it happened. You know, it's a blitz game. It's just one game. The way I compare it is if you're a professional golf player and you play a couple holes of golf with someone, anything can happen. I mean, it's random chance. I just didn't want to be embarrassed. I mean, that's all I was thinking. The thing that helped me a lot to not be embarrassed, forget about doing okay, but to not be embarrassed, he played the Breyer and the Roy Lopez. I guess everybody here knows. And that had been an opening that was starting to get popular back in my day and had evidently reemerged. I didn't even know it, but I knew where the pieces go.
Right.
I didn't play the sharpest moves, but I sort of put the pieces in the right places. So I got your white. I got a decent position, and he made an overly aggressive move at some point, and it was a blunder, and I noticed it. And, you know, of course, if I was stronger, I would have won the game. At the very end of the game, I was winning, but he had a chance to repeat moves, and I wasn't winning by enough that he wouldn't have won if he kept playing. I mean, there's just no way, but he gave me a draw.
Okay. And you also got to move the first piece at his 2016 match with Karjakin. You've been on a panel with Kasparov. You tell the story in your book of meeting a young Arkady Dvorkovich while he's like in Russia in the early 2000s. And then there's all the legends I'm sure you played. So what I'm building towards is, do you have a favorite chess memory out of all the legends you've gotten to meet?
So first I want to say, in my book, I think about chess all the time. I just told you that. And I use it sometimes in my public speaking when I'm talking about artificial intelligence. I did a debate with Gary at the Oxford Union. It was with Gary and Peter Thiel, and I had a partner. They were debating that innovation is over. We were debating you're nuts. And I'm not sure who won, actually. I honestly, truly don't know. They had a vote. I'm not actually sure the answer. But I had felt like I had seen enough of what was going on in artificial intelligence through chess. Chess has long been at the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, that I thought it was coming. I actually wrote a piece in 2010. I talk about it in my book, where I was sort of predicting that our big problem's not that innovation's coming to an end, which is, by the way, what every economist thought. I'm not making this up. Until just a couple of years ago, they thought innovation's just dying. And I said, nope, the problem, it might be too fast. It might be too fast for us humans to, you know, to socially absorb it. But I do want to mention the meeting with Arkady. I was chief economist at the IMF. That was an incredible experience. I draw a lot on it and some of the stories I tell and economic problems I look at the book. But I went to Russia, I think it was in 2003, and the people at the IMF said, okay, there are five people you have to meet, But the most important, perhaps, is this guy who's a kid, they said, who's the smartest person, smartest economist in the Kremlin. I go in and I meet Arkady Dvorkovich, and I had not remembered that who his father was a famous arbiter. And he was 30 years old, and I didn't know where he'd go and, you know, what he would do later. But it was the most amazing conversation I had. He was so candid, and on it, of course, I'm in the Kremlin. You don't necessarily believe what you're hearing. I'm not stupid. But he was so candid about what was going on. And he said, you know, if you give, 2 million police officers Makarov pistols and give our million soldiers, I forgot the name of their gun, their famous rifle, you give them rifles and there are no jobs and there's no money and their families are starving, what do you think is going to happen to the economy? We're desperate here. It's really difficult. I mean, there were a lot of other issues we discussed. That's an incredibly candid thing to be coming from somebody sitting in the middle of the Kremlin who, you know, had Putin's ear, later became, I guess, deputy prime minister or something like that. So it's a brilliant guy. He had a chessboard set up in the middle of that with a position very late in the game from I won against Sammy Reshevsky, and he had books, you know, with chess. And so it was a great experience, but not just because cool, he knew he was a chess player, but I learned things I drew on for years about Russia.
Wow, fascinating. And I should have said, for listeners who aren't familiar, he, of course, is the, Dvorkovich, of course, is the current FIDE president these many years later. And what about people that you played? Do you have a favorite game or a favorite just experience sitting across the board from someone?
Well, so a fun experience I had was in the Canadian Open. I was 15 years old and I was doing really well. I finished second, ultimately. The winner was Bent Larsen. And Bent was the number two player in the world. I think Bobby mentions this game in the article in Chess Life. And that game was scheduled to be televised on national TV. And he was so upset that he was playing me. I'm this 15-year-old punk. And there were a few much more noted players in the tournament, but I had risen to where I was the person he was playing. And so he sat there reading a newspaper and every once in a while would look up and move, you know, quickly. And I was way below him in strength, but I wasn't someone he could beat in a simile. And I got a winning position. It was a difficult position to win. I had a piece for two pawns. I've never looked at it later in a computer. It wasn't trivial, but it 100% had to be winning. And I was stupidly, and it's a big mistake I made, he offered a draw at some point and I took it. Like, what a dumb thing to do. Young players should never do that. You should just take the loss, eat it. I mean, I finished second, I might have finished third or fourth, but you know, I think it was bad for my trajectory as a chess player. You know, he is such a great player. You may notice I refer to him a couple times in the book, including in the very last chapter. I started with a Bent Larsen quote. I think he was one of the great thinkers. I started with this quote where I have a view in the book, which is coming into
playing out before our eyes. Yeah.
Rapid fire. I was saying, you know, over the next 10 years, I feel the dollar in its dominance has peaked and its share is going to come down and there's various pain to be had. And I said, what Americans don't realize is, yeah, we conquered one challenger after another, the Russians, that's where Arkady fits in. And by the way, nobody knew we were going to beat the Russians like we did. Not in my classes at Yale, nobody, I give a lot of citations, then the Japanese, then the, you know, Europeans, then the Chinese. And I say, we've been good. We're always pounding ourselves on the chest. We're just so amazing, but we've been lucky. And you can read the book. But I started with this quote from Bent Larsen saying, is it better to be good or luckier? I forget which order it was. And he said, well, both. And he went on to explain why, I don't go on. But I said, you know, Americans only think about the one and they just think no matter what they do, you know, it's going to go well. And so that's sort of the warning shot I start with at the last chapter.
Yeah, definitely.
But by the way, I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners, viewers know this. Larson had a lot of great things about him that were just way in advance of his times. He's not any more considered the iconic player that Fisher is. But for one thing, he really emphasized end games. He just killed it on end games. Maybe he was the best end game player in the world. And especially what he was really good at was cashing in against slightly weaker players. You get in an end game against him, you're going to lose. And so in tournaments, I think he wasn't as good as Spassky or Bobby against the very best players. I mean, he beat them both. But he wasn't, if you just did his rating against the top six players in the world, I think it would have been a lot lower than being number two. But if you did his rating against 50 to 100, he just slaughtered them, much less 500 to 1,000. And so end games he emphasized. But another thing is, you know, since DeepMind, everybody pushes their rook pawns. They weren't doing back in my day. That was a Larson quirk. He would just say, excuse me again about my voice. He would just say, I like to do this. And there were a few players who copied it. I'll freely admit, I did it a couple times myself. I didn't completely get it. I couldn't have explained it, but there were just, you know, a number of things where he was just way ahead of his time.
Those are amazing stories. And before we get to your book fully, any other favorite players?
Well, I mean, Bobby Fischer certainly overwhelmingly was just so exciting watching his rise, watching him play. I relate the story in the book, but, you know, watching the fifth game of the Spassky match, and just, you know, what an incredible experience, and just how it influenced everybody. Suddenly, for a short time, chess was cool. Right. Tim Commons, who was my best friend in chess, he passed away, a little older than me. He was on the West Coast, and he was like a freaking celebrity. He was giving chess lessons to Mel Brooks, Gene Wilder. Look him up. Look them up.
Jefferson Airplane, Grace Slick.
Giants. And the Grace Slick of the Jefferson Airplane and others, you know, they were paying him to give lessons. Fisher made it cool for a little while. But, you know, certainly Karpov was a god. You know, what an amazing player. I didn't overlap with Gary, of course. I'm an incredible admirer. But over the years, I've met a lot of later chess players. I mean, a person who impressed me a lot was Lev Aronian.
Yeah.
I remember once asking him, I met him, I think it was in London in 2010 at the London Chess Classic. And I said, I follow your games. I think he had reached number two around then. I follow your games and you're just kind of good at everything. You know, in my day, Fisher had to study end games. People favored some openings and favored other things. You know, you just do everything well. And why? And he was so modest. That's his personality. He said, well, Ivanchuk, you know, did that. And it was, you know, fascinating to me. I'm drifting a little bit from your question, but fascinating to me how universal players became. That was just not true in my day. You could steer for players' weaknesses and somehow they hadn't covered them. Even Karpov was not at end games when he was a junior. I mean, you know, he was not what he later became. Like, there were vulnerabilities there. Korchnoi exploited them, actually, in the late 70s when they had the world championship match. Karpov had not reached Korchnoi's level at end games. So anyway, it's been very exciting to follow all the developments in chess, where I'll go to something I learned in economics is, you know, the world just changes so fast. If you were to take Bobby Fischer today and put him in a chess, I think he'd still be really, really good. But, it, you know, show him positions and what we've learned, it's just mind-boggling.
Yeah.
You know, there's so many examples I could give, but the one I'm sort of, to me, the most amazing recent one is the Italian game, Gioco Piano, become a big thing with the top players. If you were reading the books of my day, people would say that was pathetic. You know, that's what old guys did. You're not playing for anything. You don't know what you're doing. And that's what they played, just for people who don't really know, in the 1500s, when they had the first chess books. That was the opening they were pushing. And by the 1900, at least, people say we push beyond that. So I've sort of learned that about economics, that they go on these fads, but you need to not ride with it. You need to think about longer term, not to get caught up in sort of the latest thing. And this can apply to a trend in the market, but it also can apply to ideas. You know, a lot of times the best old ideas come back. Okay, you know, as they say in chess articles, old wine in new bottles. But I learned that from chess.
That's interesting. We'll be back with more from Dr. Kenneth Rogoff after the break.
Tough to believe Domino's has never had stuffed crust pizza until now, right? Well, it's here, and it's delicious. Try Domino's new Parmesan stuffed crust pizza for $10.99 each when you mix and match. Prices higher for some locations. You must ask for this limited time offer. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary. Delivery orders subject to local store's delivery charge. Two item minimum. Bread bowl pasta, bone-in wings, and pan pizza will cost extra. Local stores may charge extra for some menu items, crust types, toppings, and sauces with this offer.
So your book is called Our Dollar, Your Problem. You tell the story of the origin of that phrase in the book, but for listeners, it might be a good intro.
So the story dates back to something John Connolly, who was Treasury Secretary under Richard Nixon in 1971. So Nixon, the dollar used to be exchangeable for gold if you were a country. So we had a system in the early 30s where you or I could exchange our dollars for gold. It actually said on your dollar bill, exchangeable for gold. Well, that stopped in the 90s, but countries could still trade gold, dollars for gold till 1971. That was very, very important backing of the global financial system for monetary stability. And Nixon was trying to pay for the Vietnam War and the Great Society that Johnson, he was in the 60s, it started. And we got inflation, not surprisingly. And if you have inflation and you're trying to peg your currency to something which doesn't have inflation, you're in trouble. And so eventually he went off of it. It was a shock. I would say Donald Trump's announcement on April 3rd of the tariff war is the biggest thing that's happened and like this disruption to the global economy since then. It was that bad back then. And it was really bad what happened after. Maybe you go back to the 30s. So they were all saying, we have all these dollars. They're holding a lot of treasury bills. They're not literally dollars. We're holding all these dollars. And you said we could trade them for gold. And you're inflating them down in value. What are we going to do? And Connolly said, it's our dollar, your problem, which was both callous and also missing the point that the inflation they did was just going to be really bad for us. So it's interesting that we're speaking on this day where I can really point to something that happened. If you think this was bad, that was incredibly bad. And what happened afterwards, I mean, there were a lot of mistakes that led up to it. So it expresses one of the reasons I liked using as a title. There's a longer title, An Insider's View of Seven Turbulent Decades of Global Finance. One of the things that appealed to me about hearkening back to that was the arrogance. Mm-hmm. Because when I was a chess player, traveling around the world, meeting other people, I really sensed how people felt about that. And, you know, got an understanding that they loved us, but they hated us. You know, frankly, they loved us more in Yugoslavia than they did in Western Europe. And I think Americans don't understand that. I will pick something that's not in my book. When George W. Bush had barely traveled when he was president, I mean, that's horrible to not do that. And I genuinely think he thought when we invaded Iraq, people would be waving American flags and just be thrilled that the Americans had come to Iraq. And I think had he traveled around like I did, you know, when he was young, maybe he would still have invaded Iraq. I don't know, but you know, you'd have a more nuanced view of those things. But the title really spoke to me because of that arrogance and also the irony. And by the way, I think what the United States is doing now is going to be very bad for the United States. The irony that, oh, that's your problem. It's not our problem. You worry about it. I like that it captured that.
Yeah. And you write in the book, so just to share a few highlights for listeners who aren't necessarily economists, that the single most important thing that people should know is that reserve currencies don't last. And I was also curious what you think people, so you predict in the book, which obviously was written before the events that have happened in the last few days, that there will be increased volatility as this sort of what could be a decades long process, or it may not be, unwinds. So what can regular people do to prepare for more tumultuous markets and economies?
That is a very tough question, because when it's happening everywhere, there's no place to hide. And over the years, when the United States goes off the rails, so we caused the Great Depression of the 1930s, there's really no question about it. I won't go into details, but our actions caused it. We caused the great inflation of the 1970s, which was the next really bad thing to happen. That's where the John Connolly story starts. We caused the global financial crisis in 2008. It isn't easy to find a place to hide in that situation. You know, the usual argument about it's hard to beat the market, it's hard to know where to diversify applies. I don't have any simple advice to people. I mean, of course, if you know some great startup and, you know, or something, right, and you want to invest in it. But when the whole world is volatile, it's not easy to find things that aren't. I don't want to get into personal finance advice, but I think it's going to be tougher period. Not that it's been easy before, but it's going to be a difficult period for everybody.
Yeah, it'll be interesting, I guess. So we have three questions from another supporter of the podcast, Hanshu, and these are right in your wheelhouse. You've covered these topics extensively, so I'll just read them. Number one, and thanks for helping to support Perpetual Chess, Han. He writes, does Ken believe that the current debt development in the USA, including entitlements, is sustainable? Number two, how do you believe that will play out based on current government policies? And actually, I'll read number three too. How does Ken's vision compare to Ray Dalio, who's a famous hedge fund manager? His vision in the book, How Countries Go Broke. I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but I'm sure.
So I'll first say, you know, Ray Dalio is a great man who's invested, you know, really brilliantly. His writings are very derivative without citation. He has a book about, you know, country bankruptcies that looks a heck of a lot like, written many years later, that looks at heck of a lot like This Time Is Different. So he's a great man, great thinker. I'm just not going to comment on it. I would say most academics are totally unaware of his work. Okay. I met him, great man, but I'm not going to comment on it. I will comment on the debt situation. I've been almost a lone voice in among academics, which are pretty left-leaning on the whole. I regard myself as a centrist. Maybe I'm like a Clinton Democrat, which these days make me far right, maybe in the Democratic Party.
Right.
Bill Clinton was president in the 1990s, I think, was it one of our great presidents. And, you know, I've debated around the world with people that you think our debt can just go like this because our interest rates are going to go like this. You just think we'll never have to pay. I've debated this with Paul Krugman. I've debated it with Larry Summers. It came up in the Peter Thiel, Garry Kasparov debate, many other people. And I would say my views have been in academics just sort of dismissed until the last few years. And I said, you know, if you look at Larry Summers, he's the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, former president of Harvard, a great thinker. I mention him very flatteringly overall in the book. But he said, if you go back to 1980, the interest rates adjusted for inflation have been going like this. I think they're going to keep going like this.
This is going down for listeners.
Going down and for listeners, sorry. I forgot that. Going down and down and down. And so really, we need to be thinking, and he wrote some pieces on this, we need to think about how fast we let debt rise relative to our income. And that's just not a big thing to worry about. Paul Krugman mentioned in the New York Times, why not be like Japan, which has twice the debt we have? Who cares? Nobody should be thinking about this. They had the, I would say, short view vision that interest rates don't go back to normal ever. So I think the high interest rates we have, I mean, they're going to come down if we have a recession. I'm talking about over the longer term. The high interest rates we have to finance our debt, and interest payments on U.S. debt have nearly tripled over the last few years as interest rates go up. That's going to suddenly become painful. And I just want to, you know, dwell on this a second longer. So I would say to them, so you don't think it matter? You think if you could use stimulus all the time and just, you know, do debt finance, it's just the greatest thing since sliced bread. In other words, run deficits to pay for new government programs. Progressives say that all the time. Okay, lovely, great. They think it'll make our income grow and grow. But you don't think it matters that the debt is high? They said, no. So I said, hey, wait, what if I told you the debt fairy came along and knocked the debt from 120 to 60% of income? Would you care? And they go, oh, that'd be fantastic. We could spend money, you know, and money. But there are trade-offs to these things. And I think we're reaching it. I don't know how it will play out, but, you know, if I had to guess, it will be one of the contributors to the burst of inflation that I'm saying. That's a way of defaulting on your debt. We just did it. I mean, you know, we knocked probably 10%, 12% of debt to GDP off our debt through the inflation that happened in the Biden years. And I think we'll have, you know, I predicted in articles and many pieces that I think we'll have something like that again. And the core of it, and my debate with those who disagree, is I don't think you can count on interest rates going back to zero or lower forever, which I think that's dreaming.
Yeah. I'm just one person, but I'm socially liberal, but I never understood that deficits don't matter. Strain of thought. It's
very self-defeating. If you're a progressive, you should be in favor of high taxes. Let's redistribute money. Let's do great things, but mostly let's pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense to me. So in closing, Dr. Rogoff, I'm sure you're busy to begin with, and today you're especially busy. You write that you met 8 presidents in your travels, which you tell some amazing stories of all the places you've been and characters, respected characters you've encountered. Do any of those experiences particularly stand out from all the world leaders you've met?
Goodness. I mean, so what's been interesting and where I've learned from Chess is I'm often meeting them and they're under great stress. And when you're that, you know, I'm an economist who works on financial crises, you're going to tend to talk to me when you're worried about some crisis happening in your country. And I'm typically not meeting them casually for tea. I might be having tea with them, but it's not casual. And so I think one of the things Chess has taught me is to deal with that stress. You know, sometimes, you know, there are things going on that are difficult. I had one small meeting with President Obama where he was yelling at me. He didn't want to hear what I was saying. He later got to like me and invited me back to the White House several times. But I think I drew on, what do you do when you just plundered a piece? Did you miss something? I'm thinking, I don't think I said what I didn't mean to say. So, you know, learning to be calm under pressure when you've made a mistake. There's nothing like playing blitz or time travel and being in time travel to sort of really handle stress. So I feel like Chess gave me a lot in some of those episodes. I tell about some of it in the book. I mean, really meeting some extraordinary people, but meeting them under extraordinary circumstances.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing like the pressure of the decision-making has to come in handy. And I'm not like a big crypto person, but it's so of the moment, broadly, not today's moment, but more broadly speaking. And you do touch on it on your book. And I'm sure as you continue your media tour, you're going to get a lot of questions about, like, if not the dollar, or if the dollar descends, what's next? Just for listeners who are curious, what's your overall take on crypto?
So I have a chapter about crypto and I talk about it elsewhere. And so the first thing to say is it does eat at the margins of the dollar's realm. So there's a lot of demand for the dollar in what we call the world underground economy. And okay, that includes drug smuggling, arms, human trafficking. Most of it is just people avoiding taxes. And I, side note, I met so many people in the 70s who had like a closet of cash, you know, for one reason or another. So I felt like, not always in the United States, I felt like my Chess travels showed me the real world, which I must say, I meet so many economists who spent their whole life in universities and never seen that. But, you know, crypto is a tool for doing that. I know a lot about it. I don't want to get into the weeds, but the world underground economy is 20% of the total economy. So the people, there are a whole number of leading thinkers, Nouriel Roubini, Jamie Dimon, who's the, you know, famous head of JP Morgan, great, you know, financier for sure. Paul Krugman, again, have all said again and again, a Nobel Prize winner, they've all said again and again, it's worthless. No, it's not worthless because we're not controlling everything about the underground economy. But I think they could regulate it much, much more than they do. I think, on the other hand, those techno enthusiasts, particularly in Silicon Valley, and they'll point me to Yuval Noah Harari's marvelous book called Sapiens, recommend it to everybody. About the history of the world through an anthropologist's eyes. He has several chapters on money that have been among the most famous chapters in the book, and very influential in Northern California. He's completely wrong about everything in that, I'll say. Just completely wrong. The idea that money is a social convention, it's whatever we want it to be, no. There's a lot of brute force behind money. The governments can control what banks have to pay out, what you have to pay your taxes in, how they pay their employees, how they pay their suppliers, lots of other things. I refer to Marco Polo's travels when he met Kublai Khan. That was the first time the West had seen was tree bark money, but paper money. He said, it's amazing that they take that. But then on the other hand, if you don't, you can be executed. And so I think the value, there's the people who say crypto is worthless are just wrong. And the people who say, yeah, it's just going to replace the dollar, that's wrong. And there are technical questions about what stable coins are, which are another family I'll leave for another day.
Okay, well said. Yeah. And of course, this is a small sample, but there's been a general observation that some people view crypto as sort of this escape hatch from the regular economy. But on days like today, when markets across the world are getting hammered, crypto tends to go down as well.
Exactly.
Well, Dr. Rogoff, I know you've got a ton to do. This has been amazing. Listeners, of course, should check out his new book, Our Dollar, Your Problem. And of course, I'm sure you'll be doing a vast podcast tour. So if you want less chess and more economic talk, I think you can find some interviews.
I like having the chess talk. I really appreciate your having the chess community is a very important part of my life. And so I really appreciate that you invited me to be on this podcast.
Okay, it's an honor. Thanks so much. Really appreciate it.
And I do think they would enjoy the book because chess is woven throughout.
Yeah, it's like little Easter eggs planted throughout the book. I definitely enjoyed it. And you'll learn a lot anyway. It's a fantastic overview of economic history and, our prescient as well. So congrats and good luck with the book launch.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.